Time to check in with our friend Chad Finn of the Boston Globe and Boston.com. Hello there, Chad.
Hey, Rich. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. How was your weekend?
My weekend was gone way too fast. I don't remember a single thing about it.
That's how mine went, too. Yeah, like boom, it was over just like that. First day of school today with a full host of students, so that was fun. A reminder of what it used to be like in the old days.
What year is this for you?
It's my Larry Bird year, 33.
Oh, all right. That's good. You know what you're doing anyway. You're a crafty vet.
Generally, although I'm at that point where I'm beginning to forget some things, but I take a lot of notes.
I do the same thing, actually. I'm not even kidding. That's how I get through the day now. Lots of scribbled notes that I can't understand afterwards.
I've done that. Sometimes I'll hold them upside down. I wonder what this meant. I can read the words, but I wonder what I was going to do. No, never mind. It'll come back to me. And then that night, I remember what I was supposed to do. Well, lots to get to here. Let's start with the Patriots last night. Interesting game as they wrapped up the preseason. Mac Jones looked just good enough to be the backup to start the year.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know what to think right now. And I've gone back and forth on this probably four or five times, Mac or Cam or Mac, over the last week, depending on who was missing practice, who was playing well in practice, who got what opportunities in the game Sunday night. And I am thinking it's Mac Jones today for a couple of reasons.
Really?
I do, yeah. Some current NBC Sports Boston, he's a writer that was in Boston, had laid out a really compelling case for it to be Mac. Part of it being that Belichick's mantra has always been the guy who deserves to play, plays at the highest level, is going to play. And that clearly has been Mac Jones through camp in most of the games. He allows them to do a little bit more offensively than Cam does. You know, Cam's a better runner. Mac runs the offense in a way that is very familiar. The other thing with that is down here in Boston, the WEI gets the quarterback every Monday, and the quarterback that Belichick gave them today is Brian Hoyer. It's supposed to be the starting quarterback. If it were Cam, it would make all sense in the world. If it were Mac Jones, who it was last week because Cam wasn't around, that would make people think maybe there's been a change of quarterback. And beyond that, this morning when Belichick talked to all of us, he still wouldn't commit to who his guy was. And I know some of this is gamesmanship with the Dolphins, but I think there's a real shot here that Mac Jones is the starting quarterback for this team. Real good shot.
You made an interesting point in your piece in the Globe that you thought originally might be a bit of a disadvantage for Mac Jones to be out there with the twos, the backups, but he's been out there with some guys who've played really well and might end up with a larger role in this Patriots team.
Yeah, I mean, Damian Harris is a heck of a running back. I think we've all grown to like him since his sort of redshirt first season here, which some Patriots running backs in the past have done. You know, Shane Vereen didn't play much as a rookie. James White hardly played at all as a rookie, and they ended up being guys that'll help you win Super Bowls. Damian Harris was on that path early, then got beat up a little bit, but when we see him on the field, he looks like a legitimate number one running back. Runs hard, runs away. People wanted to see Sony Michel run and didn't always run that way that people like, where you kind of putting your shoulder down and trucking guys, and Harris can do that. And so he's the guy, but he has had that hard time staying on the field. And I think one of the things we realized watching these three preseason games is they've got really interesting depth there. J.J. Taylor, the tiny guy, but has the kind of speed that they really need on their offense and versatility. And Ramondre Stevenson, the fourth-round pick, he kind of put himself behind the eight ball when he got here and failed his conditioning test. But it's been really impressive ever since. And he's getting raised from guys like Lewis Riddick at ESPN about somebody who could play right away. So they've got interesting pieces there if Harris has to deal with the injury issues that he's had in the past.
Now, can J.J. Taylor be the smallest guy to really contribute at that position since Mac Heron, or am I going back too far?
No, that's the thing I keep thinking of, too. That guy was so small, though. I saw an NFL Films thing on him recently where they pan the sideline and there's just, like, shots of three linemen and then Mac Heron next to him. And he what was he, like, 5'4"? I don't know if they listed him that, but it was J.J. Harris was 5'7". And Mac Heron was smaller than J.J. Harris. But for a brief time before he had personal issues, he was one of the most complete all-around backs the Patriots have ever had, like in that Kevin Falk way, you know, Andy Johnson in the 70s, guys who could do a little bit of everything. And too bad his career got derailed. But that comparison is really easy to make with Taylor because he's a little guy who clearly can do a lot of things to help your team on the football field.
We're talking with Chad Finn here on Downtown. Defensively, we know they'd be good. And I wasn't sure who might be the keys. The other day, we talked with your Globe colleague, Chris Price, and he mentioned Kyle Van Noy, and I really hadn't thought about him because we know what he can do. But, boy, we saw some of that last night. He makes a difference and is one of those guys that sometimes makes the people around him better.
Yeah, they got a couple of those guys this year who do a lot of different things to make their teammates better. I mean, just look back last season. Jawan Bentley was by far their most experienced linebacker, the guy with the green dot in his helmet that ran the defense. And he probably wasn't ready for that, but they had such an exodus with that position with Van Noy going to the Dolphins, Hightower opting out, that they're really short there. And, well, they get those two guys back this season. They signed Matthew Judon, who looks like a menace on defense. Josh Uche clearly taken a big leap forward. He looks like, at the very least, he's going to be a pass rusher that opposing offenses have to be very aware of. So all the pieces kind of fit well. But having Hightower and Van Noy back, two guys who really know what they're doing, know how to put their teammates in position to succeed, and can do a lot of different things themselves to help out on defense. They've said a lot of things that make you think this is going to be a really, really good defense. That quality of depth and versatility at linebacker is right there at the top of the list.
And I liked your reach back to the younger days of Chad Finn when you drew comparisons to Don Blackman.
It's the number 55. I think that's what it is. But you go back to those 80s Patriots teams, they had so many excellent linebackers. I mean, everybody remembers Andre Tippett, the Hall of Famer, who was the second-best pass-rushing linebacker of the era, the LT. Steve Nelson was a tackling machine forever, like, what, 73, 74 to 87, somewhere in that range. So, you know, those are great Patriots players. But then Johnny Rembert and Lawrence McGrew, Clayton Washoon, who was a kid over 200 tackles one season before wrecking his knee. He was like Steve Nelson 2.0. And Blackman's another one of those guys who was Tippett's opposite. Had a neck injury in 87 that had ended his career, but he was a really good all-around player who knew how to get after the quarterback. He kind of was a little bit of a Chris Slade type, too, although more reliable than Slade was. So you can see Uche kind of fitting into that type of role. This draft last year, if I know people complained about it, I think it's going to look pretty good in the end with Uche in the second round. Kyle Duggar looks like he's going to become a really good player. And, you know, on when you already stepped forward last year, they turns out they had a pretty good draft last year.
We're talking with Chad Finn here on Downtown. Red Sox took 2 out of 3, won the series over the weekend, but, man, that bullpen looks gassed.
It does, and it's understandable. You know, they've had to pick up the slack for the 44 starts with Garrett Richards and Martin Perez made this year, and for Erod too, really. He struggled so much this season. And they asked a lot from Matt Barnes and Garrett Whitlock and all these guys, Solomur right on down the line, and some of them seem to be running on fumes a little bit right now. They could use about is there a second all-star break? That kind of thing really helps them out right now. But as adequately as they've played recently, you know, they won 6-9, even with the crushing loss yesterday, another crushing loss. Seems like every one of their losses has been really frustrating. It feels like they're running up into some trouble here again with the bullpen wearing down, and they've been walk prone in the bullpen anyway, so just another thing to be concerned about. And now, of course, they're having COVID issues, Martin Perez being out with it now, and Kike Hernandez and Christian Arroyo limiting their offensive depth, to say the least. So they've got a lot to deal with, a lot on their plate as they begin this four-game series with Tampa.
And this is probably not the series to try and do it, but at some point I have to think Alex Cora wants to do something to build back the confidence of Matt Barnes.
Yeah, I don't know. He checked out on him pretty fast. It went from him being the closer to, you know, we're going to get him into some low leverage innings here for a while. But I guess just three or four meltdowns in a row probably made the decision pretty easy for Cora. But I think Pedro was absolutely right talking about on the MLB Network the other day. And David Ortiz reiterated the same thing, that it's clear Barnes just doesn't trust his fastball. And he's taking all his time between pitches and doing all these things that he was not doing early in the year. When he would get the ball and dial it up to 98 and there's strike one, and suddenly he's got the advantage in the in the at-bat. And he seems to have lost faith in his primary pitch. And when that happens, as Ortiz said, hitters recognize that. Hitters recognize that you lose that confidence, and it gives them more confidence, and they're getting into the batter's box with a pretty significant advantage already. So he needs to believe in his stuff. I mean, he needs better location, obviously, on some of these pitches, but he needs to believe in his repertoire because he's a good pitcher. He's still throwing pretty hard, even if the spin rate isn't quite what it was before the spider tack band. But, he's a guy who just needs to get his head straight more than anything else.
I know Chaim Bloom took some heat, perhaps deservedly so, for what they didn't do at the trade deadline. Austin Davis, Hansel Robles, but I do like what Carl Schwarber's doing so far.
Yeah, it's gone from why'd they trade for this injured guy to how can they keep him and get rid of J.D. Martinez? That seems to be the response to the last couple of days. I mean, all he's done is get on base since he got here. He hit that bomb of a home run to tie the game up, and they ended up losing, but getting fans excited about that. It's a mutual option for next year, so it's pretty unlikely that they both signed off on it. I'm sure the Red Sox would be happy to pick it up if he keeps playing like this, but he's a guy who's going to make some bucks in free agency, and unlike some of his former Cubs teammates, he hasn't turned his new fan base completely against him. They actually seem to like him here, so no thumbs down or anything like that for Fenway fans, so it's working out ideally. The only wish is that he had been ready to go when he got here, because the Yankees get that huge boost from Gallo and Rizzo right away, where the Red Sox are kind of in this waiting mode for their big acquisition to get in the lineup while things were falling apart for them. So a little bit of regret there that they didn't bring in somebody who could help right away. But Schwarber's been as advertised when he finally did get out there.
Red Sox fans were doing that thumb down idea years ago. They just used a different digit.
Yeah, it's not down. It's pointing up.
Exactly.
But, other than that, yeah, they invented it. That might be the next step for Mets fans, the way things are going there.
It might be, and maybe directed toward the people upstairs as well. So I get the Boston Globe delivered to my doorstep every Sunday morning. You're welcome. It's because of you. It's part of my ritual to drink my coffee, or read the Globe, read the main Sunday Telegram. And the best part of it yesterday, even though I had already read it online Friday, was being able to spread out my paper and read your fantastic piece on baseball cards.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I wrote a couple. We had a big series running on collectibles, and they didn't package it this way in print, but they are online. I wrote a column about sort of the state of the industry, which is the one that was in Sunday, and then another one that's been online so far about sort of my own collecting habits through the years and how cards in particular have kind of been bookmarks in my life going back to my childhood. And then my colleague Michael Silverman has parts of this coming up on the whole NFT craze, which thank God he took that, because I tried to understand it and it's still completely over my head. I think he's grasped it to the point where he can write eloquently about it. So I really appreciate that. So those should be coming out soon. I got the easy part. I just got to write about cardboard and nostalgia.
And it was great, and I think a whole lot of folks of a certain era and age, the part that really struck home was going to the store with a note to get cigarettes for your mom, and then being able to buy baseball cards with the change.
Yeah, kids don't do that nowadays, do they?
I don't think they can do that.
Baking equipment, maybe. Yeah, that was the 70s, man. I mean, as I wrote in the column, I don't think I'd believe they happened if I didn't grow up in them. Me and my cousin would walk 2 miles from our house with a couple bucks in our pocket, and we got to spend the 40 cents or whatever left over from buying Salem lights to and a loaf of bread, maybe, to buy 70s Topps baseball cards. And I was always jealous. One of my best friends, his grandparents spoiled the crap out of him. They would buy him cards by the box. They would go to the convenience store and order him a box, so he would get like 36 packs. It was just a complete mismatch. I was so jealous. I couldn't even have that kind of, I couldn't even afford that when I had a paper and made my 11 bucks a week. But, I guess the memories all remain good, even with that childhood envy.
Well, we always looked at that as cheating. Do you remember? I think they were still doing it in the 70s. I know they did in the 60s. You would get that checklist card, and you could keep track of all the cards you had and the ones you needed. And, you know, like if you get a whole box, that's not fair.
Yeah, that's just the soulless way of going about it.
Right.
It's like buying a complete set, you know, or ordering that through the mail. You're taking all the fun and suspense and memory out of it. But you know what was funny, Rich? Researching this piece I bought on eBay, a first edition of Baseball Cards Magazine, which came out when I was like in fifth grade, like 1980, 1981. And looking through there to see what the prices were for cards back then, I mean, if you could get like the time machine, from Back to the Future, that's where I'm going back to fall 1981, and I'm just buying Mickey Mantle baseball cards because I'll be all set in the future. So if you bought them then for like $80 and they're worth tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars now.
Well, I have got a big stack somewhere of Horace Clark cards that I always seem to get in every pack. I might trade you a few of those for some of those extra Sil Campusanos.
Yeah, Sil Campusano. Yeah, that was a gammon's guy. Yeah, I had the brief foray with trying to invest like in the late 80s or when I was in high school. And it just gammon's compared him to Roberto Clemente in one of his columns. He's a young outfielder in the Blue Jays system. His bat was too quick, as it turned out. That was what Gammon throw. But I have 50 of his, maybe 100 of his baseball cards in my garage if you want them for, a dollar.
Someday.
Like that. Didn't quite pan out the way I thought.
Someday it'll pay off. Well, check it out.
Still early.
That's right. Go to boston.com and you'll want to read wonderful pieces on baseball cards. Chad Finn of the Globe. Hey, Chad, thanks as always. Good talking with you, and we'll do it again soon.
Thanks a lot, Rich. Always good talking to you.